This is Evolutionary Radio. This is your host, Trevor Kuritzen. Joining me as always, I got Steve Smee.
Yeah, we have another great show. We have a guest on tonight.
Steve, do you want to do the honors? Do you want me to do the honors?
Well, let him do the honors. Who do we got tonight?
Devin, introduce yourself. Yeah,
I can do the honors. So my name is Devin Shalek. So my background anyway is I have a bachelor's degree in physical education. Some people liken that to a kinesiology degree. It's kind of the same thing. And I'm a registered exercise physiologist with the Canadian Society of Exercise Physiology. I have a strong background in working with people with chronic disease management, different types of musculoskeletal injuries, as well as working with the bariatric clinic in Edmonton. So working on obesity and diabetes management.
As cool as all that stuff is, the reason I want to get Devin on is because Devin has over 14 years of experience training himself. He's a national level bodybuilder. The problem with most sports therapists and the problem with most nutritionists is they don't really understand the difference between an athlete and the average person. I know myself in academia, I'm much more in nutrition. You know, I'm in the human nutrition realm. Most of our classes, they're geared at pregnant women, senior children, because that's where that's the majority of the people who go to these sorts of things. So, you know, to work with a bodybuilder is kind of like a niche. So someone like Devin actually understands that. There's a big difference between, you know, someone who goes to the gym and, you know, just does cardio 3 or 4 days a week and someone who's squatting 500 pounds. That's the reason we want to get Devin on, is because he can actually, it's more relatable for him. He knows what, you know, a lot of our listeners and, you know, guys who train really hard are going through. Steve, I know you got a ton of email questions for Dev. What's the first one you got?
Well, before we get into that, Devin, can you tell us a little bit about what kinesiology is? Because that's a very long word with a lot of syllables, and a lot of our listeners are probably sitting there wondering what it is. Can you tell us what that means?
Sure, Steve. So basically it means study of the human body, but a good way to think of it is the study of kind of how the body works, the joints, the muscles, how they move together, the physiology of the muscles or the fat tissue, those kinds of things, and how kind of it all ties together. So basically study of the movement of the body would be a good way to put it.
Okay, that sounds good. So in my experience, there is a huge gap when I've done physical therapy and I've seen sports doctors, between the doctors, like Trevor was saying, who seem to deal with old people. Like you walk in there and it's all old people who can barely walk, who they're like, you know, doing work on, versus a physical therapist who, let's say, works with professional or minor league athletes. Is that something that needs to be more amplified for a lot of people who are listening, who get into situations where they need a physical therapist? Is that something they should look for with a physical therapist when they walk in there and see a bunch of old people or walk in there and see a bunch of athletes? Does it make a difference?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it does make a difference. Like physical therapists, when they go through school, not a whole lot of it is sports specific, right? Like it's kind of up to each. And I'm not a physical therapist myself, but a lot of physical therapists, if you're going for physical therapy, it's kind of on their own motivation to go the extra mile to look for like sports specific type of rehabilitation or things like that. So, I mean, if I had another injury, I would probably look for a physical therapist that has a bit more of a sports background or works with more of an athletic population. Because it's also going to depend on, if you're really motivated, you're probably going to be able to push and progress faster in your rehab than, you know, 75-year-old grandma, right?
Yeah, I actually, I tell this story before on a podcast. I actually went to physical therapy. I went to a chiropractor, and it was funny because he was putting everybody who walked in on the same cookie cutter program. And I would literally be doing like bicep curls in his office with bands after I had just come from the gym doing bicep curls for 55 or 60 pounds per arm. So it was kind of laughable, the program he put me on. And it was like totally not even doing anything except, kind of moving my body around or something. Like it was kind of like a cool down session for me. He didn't really, there wasn't anything that was, I was getting out of it. And the motherfucker charged me $12,000 over 2 or 3 months going to him.
Another great example is like a massage therapist, right? I've gone to a massage therapist before and been like, okay, I want like a deep tissue sports massage. And all I got was, like a relaxation tickle massage that, it was nice and it was relaxing, but it really didn't do anything. Like she really didn't break up any adhesions and she really didn't, you know what I mean? So it's the same thing with like a physical therapist. If you don't have someone who is an athlete and understands the needs of an athlete, it's going to be exactly like you said, it's going to be some cookie cutter program that's kind of fun to do. And I mean, is obviously better than sitting on a couch, but it's really not going to help that person get back into the gym and back to training at their full capacity. Devin, you got anything to add to that?
Yeah, I was going to say the whole cookie cutter stuff. That sounds like most prep coaches for contests nowadays too. But yeah, no, the same with massage therapists. That's why it's so hard for, anyone with like kind of an athletic background to find a massage therapist because, you want to find someone that's passionate about what they do, right? And a physical therapist or a massage therapist or whoever is like helping you rehab, if they're not really into the sport or into what you're doing, they're not going to be as, we'd like to think they're as emotionally invested, but they're not. So you got to find someone that understands what you're doing, right? And the chiropractor got you pretty good, Steve.
Yeah, I know, right? It was funny because they played like God music on the intercom, like, God, and they were like big in the church and stuff. So I think they kind of used that to kind of scam people. It was a nice little scam operation they had there. But I wanted to ask you about an injury I had to deal with, and a lot of people I know have to deal with, and that's rotator cuff. And it just seems like everybody you talk to who's in the gym benching heavy or doing militaries or something is going to run into this injury over time. And I really believe half the guys that I see in the gym who are lifting heavy have some type of rotator cuff issue happening. I didn't even know I had it for like 2 or 3 years until I actually got an MRI done, because it was hard to tell that I had it. Because I'm used to being sore all the time from lifting weights. So it's kind of like I'd be inflamed. My arm would be inflamed going down my arm. I didn't know what was going on. And then I finally saw a good sports doctor. And he's like, I think you have a torn rotator cuff. Let's do an MRI. And then that's what happened. So, I mean, tell us a little about rotator cuff. Do you agree with me that this is a major issue that guys are going to deal with when they're benching and doing these heavy militaries?
Yeah, so with rotator cuff injuries, with any shoulder joint, the shoulder joint is our most mobile joint. It's the only one that can do, circumduction. So we can put it fully in a circle, right? So that means it's our least stable joint. Now, the problem with rotator cuff injuries is, the rotator cuff is multiple muscles. So it's involved with internal, external rotation through different planes of motion. So just what that means is when we say, oh, I hurt my rotator cuff, or how do I avoid rotator cuff injuries? Well, which specific muscle are we talking about? So if we're in the gym and we're like, let's say most meatheads or most athletes or most teenage guys, most people are going to do more chest and shoulder work than they are upper back work. And what happens with that is when you're doing a pushing exercise, you're also going to use a lot more of your internal rotator muscles. So what that means is on the front of your shoulder blade, deep underneath, it's called your subscapularis. And there's a few other ones in there, but they're going to internally rotate your arm in. And those are going to get tighter as we do a lot of pushing exercises. And the only way to counter that is to do external rotation exercises. So yeah, that stuff with the bands and all that, where we're, it's really hard to describe. But the biggest thing is that we want to strengthen those external rotator muscles and stretch our internal rotator muscles. So if you ever see a massage therapist, usually in 95% of people that go to the gym, we have tight pecs, tight front, tight shoulders, and tight internal rotator muscles and weak external rotator muscles of the of the shoulder. So if we have tight internal rotators and weak external rotators, that means we're kind of pulled in that kind of slouched forward position. I hope I'm explaining this okay. So the way to counter that is to try to do stretching or active release therapy on those internal rotators. So people that have had sports massage, when the massage therapist is kind of digging in your armpit, probably the most painful thing you'll experience, that's some active release on internal rotator muscles of the rotator cuff of the shoulder. But we also want to strengthen the opposing muscles, so external rotation muscles. So we can use a band or things like that, or a cable for that. And that's going to help balance that out. Because anytime we have an injury, usually it's because there's been an imbalance for long enough, and eventually snap, right? So we need to kind of correct that imbalance.
So Dev, I know we're just on a podcast here, so it's audio. So this is something you can't really show our listeners. But could you give an example of maybe like the top three external rotator cuff exercises that you like to do? I think face pulls is a great one. Just names, yep, that people listening to this podcast could, yep, write down and then YouTube after.
Yeah. So face pulls would be one. So that's going to help work our rear delts as well. But if someone was to to Google cable external rotation exercise, they would kind of see that it's, you know, elbow at your side, you know, hand out in front of you, arm bent or elbow at 90 degrees, and you're pushing your hand out. I guess you'd say, while keeping your elbow to your side. It's a very small range of motion and very lightweight. The muscles are so small. Every time we see people do this, usually they're using too much weight. So they can Google like rotator cuff external rotation exercises. The one thing I would say for sure though is don't use dumbbells. How many, like, we always see these people warming up doing these rotator cuff exercises with dumbbells standing right before they're going to do their bench press. But it doesn't work that way. Like, gravity goes down when we're holding a dumbbell, so it's not opposing the muscle. So you're going to need to use a band or a cable, ideally, for rotator cuff exercises.
I've got a question for you, Dev. So bands are becoming super popular. Where would you recommend buying them? Because this is something I've actually been looking into more myself. Because I found that a lot of the bands available on the market, they snap. Like I've snapped like three or four different bands. Is there like a website or anything that you recommend for buying bands?
Yeah, well, I bought mine from elitefts.com before. They have a lot of good products on there. I think I got the Mountain Dog Pack, kind of endorsed by John Meadows a while ago. But they have a bunch of different ones on there for different like packages of bands. Other than that, like, I'm local to Edmonton, Alberta, and there's Fitness Town that the people around there they can go to. But other than that, elitefts.com is where I bought my bands before.
Steve, I saw you wanted to chime in there.
So I wanted to ask you about this, Devin. This is a question a lot of guys ask me because I went through the whole rotator cuff thing. I could say I've made a tremendous recovery from it. Like, I literally could not even raise my arm over my head. It was that bad. And like, I'd have this really bad inflammation going down my arm. So I made a huge improvement. I couldn't do pull-ups. I couldn't go heavy, even anything on the bench press or dare do anything on the military. Now I'm starting to do bench press again. I'm doing pull-ups now, no problem. My rotator cuff doesn't bother me. I don't go super heavy. But this is the question that I asked my physical therapist, and this is a question I get asked a lot from guys, and I'll ask you the same question. Do you think I'll ever be able to bench all that weight that I was doing before. I was doing 400 raw and I weighed under 200 pounds. So that's a tremendous amount of weight. Do you think I'll ever get to that point, or is that just a pipe dream and I should just forget it?
Well, so what specific muscle did you tear in your rotator cuff? You know?
I don't know. They did an MRI. It was, it didn't require surgery. I know. So that kind of makes the question hard. So you're saying it depends on what specifically happened? It's to the degree?
Yeah. I mean, I think you could get back there. Here's the one thing to make sure of when you're bench pressing, though. And this goes for like anybody doing any pressing exercise, but especially with chest. Some of us do not have the flexibility, and we need to improve our flexibility to even have the bar touch our chest unless we do a big back arch, if we're talking about bench press. So what happens a lot of times is, and you can watch someone's shoulders, their pec might be fully stretched, and for the bar to touch their chest, they do kind of funky rotation things with their shoulder. And so we need to make sure our flexibility is okay so that to get the bar that last inch or two to touch your chest to make it a, you know, competition bench, that we don't have to do extreme internal rotation of the shoulder. And next time you're in the gym, just you'll see what I mean. That last bit of the range of motion, we have to sometimes do some weird things to get the bar there. And you don't want to do that because that's where people get in trouble if they don't have the flexibility to start off with.
My mobility was horrible back then, and I've been working on mobility exercises thanks to my physical therapist and also thanks to YouTube looking at videos. And I was doing those mobility exercises, and I felt like an idiot in the gym doing them in front of other people, but that really helped. My mobility like has improved like 100%, and I think that was a big part of why I was able to recover so well from my tear. So all you guys listening, if you have a rotator issue, work on your mobility. And even if you don't, like if you're Trevor's age and you want to start strength training, please don't forget about mobility, because if you don't have that mobility, it's going to snap. You know?
Another really common thing I see, and I see this to probably about 50% of people in the squat rack, is that their hip flexors are so tight that when they squat down, they don't have the flexibility to squat below parallel, but they do it because they know that they're supposed to. And then they kind of do like a lower back extension squat to get it back up. I just cringe, but I'm sure Devin, I'm sure you can talk about this too. A lot of people, their hip flexors are so tight, they just don't have the flexibility to squat below parallel. They should, you know, if they worked on their mobility, they would eventually be able to, but that's a huge thing I see, and that's probably the number one reason why people hurt themselves squatting.
Oh, I 100% agree. And part of that, it's really like everybody has tight hip flexors now because we do so much sitting, right? So hip flexors, when we're in a sitting position, our hip flexor muscle is shortened. So that means we sit 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day, whatever, and that muscle gets a lot tighter. It's never lengthened or stretched out, right? And it's hard to it's almost silly to think that 5-10 minutes of stretching is going to counter 10 hours of sitting, right? But, you know, we need to work on that as much as we can because that's exact. And then also ankle flexibility makes it hard for people to get lower too. But the big thing is like not everybody has the flexibility to do perfect range of motion initially. So if you can't squat all the way down without making it some really kind of weird exercise that becomes really way too complicated and unsafe, then you don't have to right away. You can work up to that, right? But I think everybody's like, oh, you got to go, you know, ass to grass or it doesn't count. And not necessarily. I mean, it depends what your goal is, right? But like, it doesn't always have to be like that. But like hip flexors, shoulder flexibility, I'd say like hip flexors and internal rotators of the shoulder, so tight rotator cuff muscles are the two biggest problems like that we run into.
Devin, do you have any suggestions on ways to increase, you know, hip flexibility and mobility, and then also ankle flexibility and mobility?
Well, I mean, really just stretching is going to be the biggest thing. So Again, we're on a podcast, so it's hard to describe. But if you're training, when you train calves, try to do a full range of motion, a deep stretch at the bottom, and that's going to help stretch out. It's called dorsiflexion, so we can do more dorsiflexion, and that'll help our foot stay flat when we're squatting further down, because we don't want to come up on our toes. And the other thing for hip flexors is, you Google some hip flexor stretches, but also try to get up and move and do less sitting. Do as little sitting as we can throughout the day, which is really hard to do. But, we even have available at work now, like standing desks and things like that, that can be really helpful. And also just another point is, like, the more we sit, it's a strong correlation with a ton of chronic diseases, even if we're exercising intensely for an hour or two a day. So the more we can, like, stand up, pretty much the better.
This brings me to the next thing, because this is another injury that I've had to deal with, is my neck has been absolutely horrible for years now. And it's because I had a sit-down job ever since college. So I've gone almost 20 years sitting down. A year and a half ago, I got a stand-up desk. And it's stopped the problem. And I've been working on, correcting my posture. And I've been working on doing yoga exercises. And that's helped reverse this tremendously. My neck feels better now than it has in years. But unfortunately, the damage, was done from that. So that's a great tip. Guys, a stand-up desk is $400 or $500, a good quality one. That is the best investment you can make. You can take it with you to work. You can keep it at home in your home office. It will change. It will stop, the destruction of your neck and back. I highly recommend it. So Devin, with that, let me ask you, lots of us have desk jobs. It's really, really bad. The posture issue and the imbalances issue, what are some ways of correcting that besides getting a stand-up desk?
A few things, I guess, would be, we talk about stretching the hip flexors, stretching as much as we can. The other thing is, so when we have a tight muscle, that means the opposing muscle that does the opposite action would be longer and weak. So when we have tight hip flexors, that pulls us into what's called anterior pelvic tilt, which sounds fancy. Think of, a girl sticking her butt out a little bit when she's walking. She probably has anterior pelvic tilt. Her hips are tilted forward. So a way to strengthen this is not just to stretch the hip flexors, but also to strengthen the lower abdominals. So leg raise is a good way, but also strengthen the glutes to kind of pull that pelvis back into line. So those are two things that can help there. And the other thing with the shoulders and the neck is, and because also if they're weight training, we probably have tight pecs and internal rotators. Is to do, like Trevor suggested earlier, face folds or something where we do an upper back exercise where we're pulling with our elbows kind of high and out. That's going to help our shoulder, the muscles in our upper back that help retract our scapula to help pull us more into line that way. So that's going to help with our posture a lot. Go ahead.
No, you finish, then I'll go.
Okay, I was just going to say, whenever we have a tight muscle, we always want to think, okay, we want to stretch that muscle, or we do active release therapy, which is why it's so helpful on the hips from a good massage therapist, and then also on the pecs and internal rotators of the shoulder. And then also we want to strengthen the opposing muscle. Because I think if one muscle is tight and it's pulling us that way, if we can strengthen the other one, because the other one's the opposite muscle is probably weak, then we can kind of pull things back into the line. So tight pecs and internal rotators, well, we probably have a weak upper back. So we want to strengthen those muscles to help kind of pull us back into alignment.
So I'm gonna really simplify this in kind of like layman's terms. So every muscle in your body, it has an opposition muscle. Basically, your muscles, okay, your body, they're in pairs. The easiest analogy is your bicep and tricep, right? So if what Devin's basically saying is if you have a tight bicep, you want to stretch that bicep but you also want to focus on strengthening your tricep. You want to basically take a two-pronged approach to recovery. I have a great suggestion for any of our listeners with a desk job, especially if you work for a big company. If you go to your doctor and say you're experiencing lower back pain from sitting all day, that doctor will write you a medical note suggesting that you get a stand-up desk and suggesting that every 90 minutes you go for a 10-minute walk or something like that. If you take that to your employer, there's no way that they can say you can't have a stand-up desk. They'll probably even pay for it. And then that way also you have that flexibility where every 90 minutes you can go walk around and get the blood flowing, because our bodies are not designed to sit in one position for, you know, 4 hours and then take a lunch. So that's a great piece of advice. And that's one thing I actually did when I was working as an engineer. And it was like just being able to, you know, every 90 minutes, just walk around for 10 minutes and get some circulation back in your legs. It'll make all the difference. Devin, I had a question for you. So
yeah, sure.
I have no injuries, perfectly healthy. Whenever I go to the gym, you know, sometimes like my knee will hurt a little bit or it'll crack a little bit, or I'll be benching and, you know, one of my elbows will feel a little tight. Is having some small nags and tears here and there, is that normal? I think almost like it's gotten to the point now where as a society, we're overreacting. And every time, you know, something's a little bit tight, we think like we have an injury. Like I've always just felt like, you know, if I'm training hard multiple days per week, always something's going to be a little bit tight or a little bit off. And I've never really given it much thought. What are your thoughts? Should I be paying more attention if, you know, I'm squatting and my left knee feels a little tight that day? Or is that just, you know, life and it's kind of normal?
Well, I think both answers are kind of like, I think you're right on both parts. Like, that's going to be kind of normal, but usually like, it's kind of like a wear pattern. So if your left knee is bothering you and then it starts bothering you a little bit more, well, shit, maybe something's a little bit off with our form during that exercise, right? You know, maybe we're leaning one way or maybe one hip's a little tighter. So like that on that side, you're like, you'd be coming up a little more on your toe, put a little more pressure on the knee or something like that. I think the other thing though is, I think it's normal to a degree. I think the way to help avoid that though, as like time goes on, is like to periodize your training, which like we could have like 20 episodes on periodization of training. But I mean, you can't train ball to the wall, high volume to failure all the time. You know, you'll run yourself into the ground. So like, maybe your knee is starting to bug you, or like we're starting to run into aches and pains, and then, you know, the training switches to like a less frequent block where we have 1 to 2 weeks of a, you know, what we commonly call the deload period, where we back off the weights and the training volume a little bit to rest up a little bit, and then we go back down. And then you can always say the cliche of kind of listening to your body helps. But I think some inflammation in the joints is going to be really hard to avoid. And like I know there's certain things we can do to help alleviate that. And I think you had the gorilla cameras done before. But like certain peptides could help a lot with inflammation and things like that too.
Good answer. Steve, do you have any more questions? Steve, go ahead.
Yeah. What are some maintenance things we should be doing? We're hardcore lifters. We lift weights 3, 4, 5 times a week. What are some maintenance things we should be doing? Some tips. I'll give you an example with me, hot yoga. I actually went to an osteopath, I think it's called, and he's a Western doctor. And he actually told me, you know, for my neck, he's like, I want you to do hot yoga. And I kind of like was shocked because he's a Western doctor telling me to do hot yoga. Usually you would think like an Eastern medicine hippie type of doctor would say something like that. So I was kind of surprised, but I think more Western doctors are starting to, you know, do things outside of just writing drugs to people, which is a good thing. So that's helped me a lot. The hot yoga, doing that once a week, has really helped me with my flexibility, you know, with my endurance, with everything. So do you agree with the hot yoga or yoga? And what are some other tips you can tell guys to be doing to kind of stay healthy?
Well, I mean, hot yoga is great. I think Now, the only thing to say is, like, I'll say yoga is great. Hot yoga, like, the jury is kind of out whether there's extra benefit to it. I think any type of relaxation, stretching, exercise is going to be good, especially yoga. You know, as we get more advanced with our weight training, if we are, or like you were saying, you're benching 400 pounds, you basically become higher maintenance. Like, it's more work to take care of your body and stay healthy. So yoga is a good way. Foam rolling is really good as well. Especially kind of on our IT bands, our glutes, our lower back. Those are like trouble areas that when they get tight, they're going to really affect our mechanics with certain exercises, especially with squats. And then we're going to start running into more aches and pains. And, you know, one thing, so a term that you guys can, or that listeners can look up, it's called the kinetic chain. But basically one joint, if it's out of sync, it's going to affect the next joint and so on. So if our ankle flexibility is an issue, that's going to affect how our knees track and how our knees are when we squat. And then our back and our hips are going to be affected. So any type of stretching, hot yoga, foam rolling, those are going to be good things. And the other thing to help, like, keep with maintenance and things like that, that I mentioned earlier, was periodization of training. So after, you know, 6 to 8 to maybe 10 weeks of hard training, it's a good idea to kind of back off the weights or back off the training intensity for a week or two, just because then that's going to help the joints a little bit. We can, during that time, we can do more yoga or stretching or relaxation exercises. Those are all going to be good things.
Devin, these are things I want to pick your brain on, because obviously sure, you're a very smart guy. I mean, you make your living training people. You've got tons of experience. I mean, I'll put your Instagram. What is your Instagram? I think it's just Devin Chalek. All one.
It's Devo Chal. So DevoChal.
Anyways, any of our listeners, go look him up on Instagram, and you can tell this guy obviously knows what he's talking about. So two things I want to pick your brain on. What are some of your favorite supplements to reduce inflammation? You know, we've talked about things like omega-3 fatty acids on the show in depth. We've talked about vitamin C in depth. We had Dr. Gary on, and he's a huge advocate of vitamin C. What are some other supplements that you like for reducing inflammation? You know, things like maybe like turmeric and things like that. And then periodization, you know, what does periodization look like for you? You know, like, I feel like we, as gym goers, we have this, you know, beast mode mentality, and we're always trying to beat the logbook. And, you know, if you don't leave the gym feeling like you just gave birth, you almost feel like that wasn't a productive workout. But obviously there's a time for training like that, but there's also a time for focusing on rest and recovery. So touch on supplements, and then touch on deloading, why it's important, and then how to know when to deload, how often to deload, things like that.
Yeah, sure. So for supplements, I think, like, just general health supplements are really good. And turmeric, you mentioned, also has a whole body anti-inflammatory effect. The fish oils are probably the biggest thing, though, that, you know, that over-the-counter everybody knows about. And not just for anti-inflammatory effects, but, I mean, we're talking cholesterol, lipids, and I'm sure some of our listeners are obviously probably diving into performance enhancers a little bit. So cholesterol.
The reason we have such a loyal following is because we openly talk about steroids on this show. I would say 50% of our listeners are enhanced, and the 50% and the few that aren't are most likely females.
Well, so there you go. So, then we're talking about periodization and stuff too. Then I'll also tie that into the hormonal piece as well. But fish oil, because, you know, especially with what's going on in the bodybuilding community lately, and we see all the heart effects, like, take your fish oil, take your heart health supplements, like, and then also, you know, as far as inflammatory goes, do your cardio, keep your body weight in check as well. Because if we're talking about keeping our joints healthy and avoiding injury, walking around at 300 pounds, you know, when you can, let's say we have a monster listening to this, and walking around at 300 pounds when you could walk around at 270 or 260, that's going to save your joints a ton. So, you know, here's another stat for people. Every pound you gain is 4 pounds of extra pressure on the knees and 6 extra pounds on your hips, okay? And you can amplify that a ton when we're going up and down stairs. So keeping that body weight in check and not getting heavier than we need to, even if we're bulking up, no excuse to just keep throwing weight on our body, because, you know, it's not just the wear and tear in the gym. It's that walking all day. That's hard on our knees. That's hard on our back. Everything, right? So, like, keeping that in check, I'm going a little off topic there, but as far as supplements go, the fish oils, multivitamin, turmeric, and I know you and I talked a little bit about different versions of curcumin for anti-inflammatory. But if people wanted to look up injectable curcumin, I think that there's some studies on that being pretty beneficial for limiting the hypertrophy of the heart. I'm not too sure on that, though, if people can look that up. And then the TB500. So the science is there on that. You did have the girl at Chemist on before, right?
Yeah, we had him on a couple of times. Who are you ordering your peptides from? I know Boston Lloyd's peptide site sells it, so I'd probably go from him, 3ccresearch.com. But the scary thing about peptides, Devin, is like it's a crapshoot as to what you get. Like I've had clients order TB500 before and they got like weird rashes, they got welts. Like the peptide market, it's scary right now. It's like chemical warfare.
Well, I order mine from Canada Peptides Direct, and I know the guy personally who owns it. And I'm using TB500 right now. I got into my left elbow. I was getting some pretty bad tendonitis, and I've been using TB for about 2 weeks now, 2 milligrams twice a week. And I can, like, it is unbelievable how much better my elbow feels. I was having trouble, like, training chest at all, any type of, like, dumbbell that was like close to what my working weights would be, there was not a chance. And then you know, just last week I was using the weights that I was back up to, no problems at all. And so I'm a believer in TB500, and that's Canada Peptides Direct. It's just in Alberta here, and it's been pretty helpful for me for sure.
Okay, for sure. So our US listeners can check out Boston site. And then our Canadian listeners can check out Canadian Peptides Direct. Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, I use TB500. I've used it several times. The first time I used it, it was unbelievable. And then since then, I just felt like it was fake because it didn't do shit for me. So, gosh, if you can find a good peptide company like that has legit TB500, this stuff is amazing. You know, it's really amazing stuff.
Have you tried any SARMs like Nutribol or Ostarine or anything like that? Because that I know so, Steve got great results from.
Well, I use the non-secretolog version of MK 677. So I noticed the effects of that. So I use the real thing for that. But for the MK 677, I have tried that. And so here's the thing with that though. I'm a type 1 diabetic. Okay. So MK677, it's a growth hormone pulse, right? So, but the thing is, for type 1 diabetic, the only insulin I get is what I give, right? And we know growth hormone causes insulin resistance. And with the MK, it's in a pulsatile fashion, kind of sporadically throughout the day. So I actually can't take it. It will put my blood sugars all over the place because it's kind of inconsistent. And I've talked to other type 1 diabetics that are high-level athletes. One's a Mr. Olympia physique guy who we probably know. Same kind of thing, can't take MK677. But it's probably the most popular used supplement or drug out there, I think, right now that people aren't really talking about. I mean, if you ask competitors, everybody's on it. And as far as like just the joint support, you know, the sleep, I'd recommend it just about everybody.
So the unfortunate thing is that, Devin, you obviously can't use it, but the positive is that at least we know it works. So
yeah.
Anyone listening to this who is skeptical about it, well, Devin has real living proof that it does work.
And trust me, I didn't just try it once. I was like, okay, no, there's got to be something. you know, I use an insulin pump. So they came, maybe my pump was wrong. It malfunctioned or something. Try it again. Nope, same thing. And then, you know, I messaged a few people I know and same thing for them. So that's too, that's unfortunate because that would be a nice cost saver to be able to use that. But it's, you know, I would vouch for it for sure for people.
So Devin, talk, Steve, go ahead. And then Devin, talk to us a little bit about deloading. We got about 15 minutes left.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick your brain too, Devin. I always ask our guests this because I want to see their opinion. But what separates, you know, the successful people at this? Because most people join the gym, they sign up for a year membership, they work out for like a few weeks, and then they work out like once a week or and then just quit. I know so many people, they have gym memberships who haven't been to the gym in months. They're just paying a gym membership every month for nothing. And that's what gyms like, the franchise gyms. You know, they like that because people pay a membership and don't show up and use the equipment. So it's a beautiful thing for them. But what separates the regulars from the other people? Is that something that you think the person's born with? Or is that something they were raised watching something in their life that made them so obsessed? Because Trevor and I, you know, we've been lifting weights since we're like teenagers, and we, you know, through everything, we're gonna find a way to get to the gym. And I'm sure you're the same way too.
My insight on this is, when I was working with more people at Alberta Health Services, the whole thing was like getting people active, right? And so what are the hurdles to that? There's one big thing is they get discouraged right off the bat. People want to make a life change. And let's talk, you know, New Year's isn't far away, okay? But we get really gung-ho. I'm going to get the gym membership. I'm going to go to the gym. And people say, I'm going to go to the gym 6 days a week. I'm going to fucking kill it for 2 hours a day. And what happens? 2 weeks in, they can barely move. They're just destroyed. And they say, forget this. The gym's not for me. So that kind of gets into progression and periodization. People need to just start slow. If they're very sedentary, not doing anything, like go 1 to 2 times a week. Do a program that's, you know, 30 minutes a day, 3 times a week. They don't have to go like from doing nothing to, you know, doing what we're doing in the gym or spending that kind of time right away, because they're going to get sore. They're going to be overwhelmed. And then they're going to get discouraged and quit. And then they're not going to go back for a bit. I think it's the same thing with like a lot of people that start a diet. There's so many myths out there. They start some crazy unsustainable diet, or they don't eat, or they think they're eating healthy, but they're not. And then they don't get any results. So what do they think? Well, I'm just going to be overweight.
I love it. A perfect example. I don't really train people for general health and wellness anymore just because I'm so busy and it doesn't really interest me. But I had a family friend, they were really struggling and they reached out to me. So they hired someone that they found on Instagram, and basically this person knew nothing about diet or training. They hired this person. I looked at the nutrition program this person gave someone. This is a complete beginner, and it was set foods. Everything was weighed out. It was 6 meals a day. And I'm like, this person is 300 pounds. If you told this person to start walking 30 minutes every day and cut out pop, they would lose like 5 pounds a week, right? So I basically said, okay, rip up that program. You don't need to do walking lunges and box jump squats or anything. Start walking 30 minutes every single day. That's all you have to do. And I want you to only eat your calories. You're not allowed to drink your calories anymore. So if you want pop, you can have diet pop. If you want coffee, you have to sweeten it with things like Splenda. You're not allowed to, you know, use cream anymore in your coffee. And sure enough, that person was losing 5 to 10 pounds a week. Cause like, it's exactly what you said, Devin, is like, we have this all or nothing approach as a society. You know, someone's like, I should start exercising. So then they get a gym membership. They go twice per day, every single day for, you know, 2 weeks. They burn themselves out. And then they're like, well, this, I feel like crap. I'm supposed to start feeling better. My joints hurt. My knees hurt. This is stupid. And they never go again. when what that person should have done is, you know, maybe go three times per week, you know, do 30 minutes of weights, 30 minutes of cardio, go in the steam room for 20 minutes and head home. Something simple and maintainable.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's like where, they want fast results, but they don't quite realize that you can't speed it up too much, right? It has to be something sustainable. And you get a 300-pound person who's never done anything and very obese, and you get them like running steroids or doing something crazy. Well, their knees are going to be blown up from that. Like, they're going to run into like injuries, right? And then they're not going to be able to work out for 4 months, right? So, like, it's exactly like you said. Like just kind of dispelling myths around it is really important too.
Devin, we got a little over 5 minutes left. So talk to us about deloading, why that's important. And the biggest thing I want to know is, how do you know it's time to deload?
Okay, so like there's a couple things. Short-term overtraining is a great thing if you deload after. We kind of call this overreaching, where you're just a little bit overtrained and then you pull back for a week or two. And powerlifters do this all the time, where they'll kind of ramp up and then it's a few really hard weeks, pull back, and then they get back into it 2 weeks later and they're stronger than ever before, that type of thing. Now, things to look for if you're overtraining would be like an elevated resting heart rate when you wake up, blood pressure, maybe sleep's not as good, you feel like kind of tired all the time. But if you're at that point, we're kind of in a bit of trouble. So the thing to look for is, people can train at higher volumes for maybe 4 to 10 weeks, maybe, if it's a bodybuilding split. And by that, I mean you're not doing heavy, low-rep sets. Here's the big thing to remember is that we have training volume, so how many sets we do in the gym, training intensity, and that doesn't mean how hard we think we're working. It means how close we are to maximum, like 100% of our 10-rep max would be 100% of that, how many force reps we're doing, how much we're doing task failure. And then there's training frequency. How often are we training? How often are we training to body part? We can look at those as all having an inverse rate relationship to each other. So what that means is you can't have all three high at the same time. They have to be balanced. So if you're training a lot of sets, a lot of volume, you can't be training every set to failure. It's impossible. And you can't be training 7 days a week, right? So you want to cycle those things. So if you're training for a high volume period of time with a lot of intensity, you're probably not doing 6-7 days a week. You know, if you're training with high frequency, you're doing each body part 3 times a week, you're not doing 20 sets for each body part per day. So like we could dive into that a lot more, but I won't. I'll get to the other part. But the big thing to remember is when we start getting weaker and our performance starts to decline, that's when we want to think about a deload. So if I'm trying to gain some muscle, I'm eating a calorie surplus, gaining weight, and I'm getting stronger, and then the 6th, 7th week, you know, I'm still gaining weight maybe because my calories are high enough, but my workouts are really drag and I'm tired, my joints are starting to hurt, that's the time where we want to scale things back for 2 weeks and then maybe change the program design, or we can start back over at something similar, but that's when we want to pull back. And I would do something like, if we're doing 6 days a week or 5 days a week in the gym, do 3 to 4, do 70 to 80% of the amount of volume, so amount of sets we're doing per day, and don't take anything past muscular failure. So you go, you get a decent workout in, you get a good pump. I hate that when people say that word, but that's how you want to look at your workout. And then after a couple of weeks like that, increase the intensity again.
This is what I tell
my one more thing.
Yeah, go.
I'll just touch on one more thing though. So like another time that's really important to deload usually is for a lot of people is after like a contest or after like a powerlifting meet. That's when we really ramp things up. And for bodybuilding, a lot of times people really try to go hard after a show and get those post-contest gains, they'd be called. But that's not necessarily the time. Like we are so run into the ground. And people want to gain muscle after a show, but it's easy to gain muscle after a contest with, you know, all the hormones still in your system. Even if you're not taking them, they're still acting in your system, you know, and just training with moderately high intensity. You don't have to be squatting 600 pounds a week after your contest or something like that. That's where you're going to run into problems. and just all the adrenal fatigue from all the, you know, the hormones, the gear in your system and all that shit and all the dieting and body fat, that's the time to like have a bit of a deload immediately after a contest. Absolutely, like, for sure.
You'll probably like this, Dev. I had to take a deload week, and I never took a deload week before because I was, you know, hardcore. This is when I was 18 and Ron Parlow was training me. I was like, so what do I do on a deload week? He's like, you train like a lazy pro bodybuilder. I'm like, what does that mean? He's like, you get a pump, you spend the majority of your time looking at yourself in the mirror and talking to cute girls, and you don't break a sweat. He's like, that's how I want you to train for a week. I was like, okay, I can do that. So,
we love Ron. He has good advice.
No, he's a great guy. I got to get him on the show. Steve, do you have any closing questions for Devin before I close up the show?
Well, I just want to hear, Devin, is there one or two myths, training, nutrition? Because you mentioned before there's so many nutrition myths and people trip themselves up. Can you give us an example of a nutrition myth and a workout myth that are tripping people up?
Ooh, that's a good one. For training, I'm going to say that anyone who says you have to do this exercise is full of shit. Okay. You have to squat. No, you don't. Maybe you have to do a squatting type of movement if you want big legs, but you don't have to still, or you have to bench press, or you have to deadlift. No, you don't. Like there's other alternatives to just about everything. So there's no like you have to do this exercise or must do exercise. And then for nutrition, I think, you guys have probably, I haven't listened to all the podcasts, but I guess meal frequency is probably the biggest thing that you have to eat every couple hours.
Talk to us about protein requirements. That's a good one.
Yeah, actually, that's a really good one. So, like, here's how most people have weight. Most people eat more protein than they eat. And the way to look at it is, protein requirements are like, you know, a gram, gram and a half a pound per pound of body weight is like more than you need. But to get the amount of leucine to sufficiently turn on the mTOR pathway, so Lane Norton has a lot of research on this. To turn on the mTOR pathway, which is the main one for protein synthesis and muscle building, you need a certain amount of leucine per meal. So usually to get that amount of leucine, you need 40 to 50 grams of protein per meal, right? And then you can stimulate that pathway every 3 to 5 hours, 4 to 6 hours, I think he says. And that's a couple of the studies that he referenced and talked about. And so, you know, then protein adds up quite a bit throughout the day. If you're eating 40 to or 50 grams of protein from a whole protein source, and then you multiply that by, you know, how many meals you're having a day, and then that's not really counting the indirect sources like oatmeal or stuff that aren't going to have a ton of leucine in there. So then protein adds up quite a bit, but if it's just like whey isolate, where you're getting a very good amount of amino acids in there, it's going to be like 35 grams of protein. Maybe 40 is going to max out for just about anybody.
Good point. Something we've talked about. I know Steve doesn't eat that much protein at all.
Just want to mention, and you'll find this funny, Devin. I remember 10, 12 years ago on forums, on these bodybuilding forums, if you posted your diet and it didn't have at least 500 or 600 grams of protein a day, you'd get flamed. You'd get flamed by the moderators, by the staff, vets. It's like, you got to get at least 500 grams of protein a day or your muscles are going to shrink. That's what they used to think back then. Now people don't think, now, you know, it's totally changed the way people think. It's funny to me.
Well, and it's nice that even like the pro bodybuilders and the guys that are like really followed by the kids a lot more, like if not every meal plan you see posted is like meal two, 14 ounces of steak. Like, no, like that's just ridiculous, you know? It's still out there a little bit.
So Devin, we're at our hour here. There's two reasons I wanted to get you on the show. I wanted to get you on the show, obviously, because you know a lot about injuries, sport-specific injuries, therapy, things like that. But I also wanted to get you on to pick your brain about your experiences at the bariatric clinic and dealing with eating disorders, because I know the vast majority of people in the bodybuilding industry don't have a healthy relationship with food. So Devin has been nice enough. He's going to come back on the show and we're going to do an entire episode on eating disorders, the mind, how hunger works, what signals hunger, because a big difference between emotional eating and physical eating. It's going to be a really, really good episode. So that's going to be the next episode we do. Devin, for people who want to contact you, learn more about your training services, things like that, what's the best way for people to reach you?
So they can send me a message on Instagram. So that's Instagram or Facebook. You guys can probably like say my name on or something. Or my email is just the letter D, Chalukk, so DCHALUK, fitness@gmail.com. So they can just send me an email or message through social media. I'm pretty active on there, and then we can get talking. And thanks, and I look forward to being on again, because every single person in the world is an emotional eater, whether they want to, like, or whether they realize it or not. And after, and especially competitors, like, we develop unhealthy relationships with food.
Honestly, Devin, that's one of the main reasons I decided to retire from competing, is when you compete, whether you intend for it or not, no matter how healthy a relationship you think you have with food, you don't have a healthy relationship with food, because you weigh everything you eat. You're constantly thinking about your next meal. You're constantly looking at the clock. You're thinking, okay, I ate at 2. Oh my goodness, it's 5. I need to eat meal 4 now, because if I don't, meal 5 and 6 won't be, like, it literally was taking over my life. And anyone who has done a bodybuilding show understands what I'm talking about. So that's honestly one of the main reasons I retired. It has nothing to do with the training or anything like that. It's just the diet aspect of it. And that's one of the unfortunate things about bodybuilding, is to exceed at a high level, it really kind of does have to take over your life.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing really more to add to it. Devin, we appreciate you having on. Everyone, make sure to check out the next episode, because Devin's going to come back on and we're going to do an entire episode on emotional eating. So be on the lookout for that.